Talk given Sunday, 10th September, 1972. Let us consider this afternoon with as calm a mind as possible this topic of violence. This very week, an event of great violence has taken place. A violence which affects not only the body, but also violence of the mind and the heart. This terrible tragedy in Munich invades one of the most harmless and agreeable aspects of human life. These Olympic Games are intended to represent man's growing conception of the brotherhood of man. And it is precisely that which has been stained. It is something which we should consider very deeply indeed. Violence, especially since this last war, in our modern age, is rapidly growing in intensity. Everywhere there's a breakdown of human relationships. There is a breakdown of human morality. There is an increasingly ruthless and evil self-assertion taking place everywhere in the world. It is not confined to any one country or place. It occurs everywhere now. And those of us who have looked into the history of man will notice two things particularly: that this phenomenon of violence goes right back into human history, and all measures which are taken as countermeasures against violence are also violent measures and have never succeeded in bringing about harmony, peace, have never allowed the milk of human kindness to flow freely. These are two outstanding facts about violence. We also know what a powerful part violence plays in our own daily life. Time and again, we erupt in anger, in hate, in our own minds. We may do it in the name of justice and honor and all the rest of it. We may talk of righteous indignation and so forth. But they are all expressions of violence. And if there is violence in the psyche, there will inevitably be violence physically, if not in our own life, in somebody else's life. Because make no mistake about it, The psyche of the individual is not his exclusive property. Our psyches interact all the time. They influence each other all the time. Well, one may say that that is one's thumbnail or one's heart is here and so forth, and regard it as one's exclusive property, which is more or less true anyway, for all common garden purposes. But where the mind is concerned, we are thought, feeling, and speech are concerned. They have universal interaction. Therefore, it becomes extremely important for us to realize that violence in the mind, in our thought and our feeling, is a force which contributes to the world violence. And the same with speech. Now let us look at this phenomenon of violence as it goes back into the past. There's no need for me to detail the history of violence. Anybody and everybody knows that. You all know about that. Violence everywhere throughout history. But it is very interesting to notice that in the religious context, violence has been recognized and presented in interesting ways. Let me just read this little extract from the Zarathustrian scriptures. And this is the most authentic of all, the Gathas of Zarathustra. In this little chapter which deals with the creation, this is how it starts off. The soul of creation cried unto God in grief, "For whom hast thou brought me into being? And who shaped me? Wrath and rapine, insolence, aggression and violence sit upon me in my affliction. No one is my protector except thee, O God. So reveal thou to me the good shepherd, the deliverer." Thereupon, the architect of creation, and in the Zarathustrian scripture, the architect of creation is not identical with God. God is Ahura Mazda, Lord of life and wisdom. Mazda is wisdom, Ahura is life. Lord of life and wisdom. The architect of creation in the original Avastan is Geush Tasha. Just as the soul of creation is Geush Urva. Thereupon the architect of creation questioned Asha. Asha stands for the eternal order of things, the divine law, for holiness. All three things. Questioned Asha, "Who will be the prophet of your creation? When will you grant her a ruler as the good shepherd and diligent nourisher of the universe? Who will be her lord for her joy and bliss, who shall repel the wrath of the wicked?" To him, Asha, who wounds not, nor is hostile to creation. Now note very carefully, this is very symbolic language. Asha, truth, righteousness, the divine law, holiness. Asha answers, Asha who wounds not, nor is hostile to creation, meaning all creation. Those who are good as well as those who are bad, the oppressor and the oppressed alike. Made reply, I know not one amongst these heavenly hosts by whom righteous mortals may be led to the light. He must indeed be the most powerful in uprightness, if to his call the zealous shall respond. You see the fundamental basis, the utter purity of the person, the perfect morality of the person. He must indeed be the most powerful in uprightness, if to his call the zealous shall respond. Asha continued, Mazda, that is wisdom, most wise, is the supreme knower of all actions performed in the past, and indeed of those which will be performed in the future. Of all these, he himself is the discriminating Lord, be it with us as he wills. Then the architect of creation prayed unto God, saying, Thus in truth, with these uplifted hands, invoking Ahura, life, may my soul and that of the revolving creation reach Mazda, wisdom, and place before him these puzzling questions. Does no harm ever come to those who live the truth? You see how all this applies to us ourselves in our own life. Nor to those industrious workers for salvation, even though they dwell in the midst of the wicked. Then spoke out Ahura Mazda, the omniscient, enlivening life's web with his all-pervading breath. Remember, the gathas are written in poetry, entirely in poetic form. Hast thou not found a single spiritual master on earth, nor yet a prophet walking hand in hand with Asha to succor thee? Ahura Mazda is answering the architect of creation. Was it for this that I created and molded thee as the shepherd and preserver of my creation? Then one of the divine powers speaks. Ahura Mazda, the glorious, of one will with his divine law, molded the holy word of sacrifice for the sweet nourishment of his creation and for the enlightened. He framed his divine decrees. O Vahumana, Vahumana is the good mind. Mind only, pure mind, transcendent mind, that energy which deals unto us and which we cannot control or command. O Vahumana, thou embodiment of the good mind, whom hast thou claimed to give voice to these, the holy word and divine decrees before all mankind? Vahumana, the good mind, replied, Here in this heavenly sphere, only one such is known to me, who alone has listened to our divine decrees, and that one is Zarathustra. He is eager to proclaim the glory of Mazda, of wisdom, and his eternal law, Asha, in songs of praise to us. So let him be blessed with sweetness of speech. Thereupon the soul of creation lifted up her voice and wept, saying, Now must I submit to an ineffectual leader, to the words of a man without weapons, instead of him whom I had longed for, a mighty ruler. You see the significance? We, in our dualistic consciousness, think in terms of overcoming wrath and rapine and oppression and all the rest of it with violence. We think of overcoming violence with violence. When, if ever, shall he come into being who will succor me with the might of his hands? The might of his hands. Isn't this extraordinarily like the Jewish expectation of the Messiah, a scion of the royal house of David, who with his sword would subdue his enemies and establish righteousness and peace and harmony, the impossible thing? And who comes? The sinless one who suffers, who is the servant, not the ruler. And it's the same thing here. Then after a time, the soul of creation is reconciled to what is to happen and continues, O Lord of life, grant unto them, that is to Zarathustra and his disciples, eminence and sovereignty through Asha, holiness, purity, righteousness, truth, the divine law. And through Vahumana, the good mind, good in the sense of the perfect mind, the mind which, in the words of the Buddha, is not liable to delusion. And through the good mind, that thereby they may establish a joyous and blissful existence. Establish a joyous and blissful existence. I also, O Lord of wisdom, look upon thee as the prime giver of this gift. Then Zarathustra arose and said, When will Asha, holiness, Vahumana, the pure mind, Kshatra, power, the power of pure mind. And this is the power that one can wield without ever misusing it when there is the perfect harmony of both love and wisdom in the transcendent sense. O wisdom, and you, O divine powers, accept the teaching of the great Magga Brotherhood, Zarathustra and his disciples. You know, you call them the Magi, or it's the Magga Brotherhood. O living God, come now to us and let us be the most humble partakers of your divine consecrations. Now that's an extraordinary piece of writing. It's very terse, it's very deep, and it needs remarkably penetrative understanding. All these scriptures fundamentally talk about us, ourselves, our life, our mental and psychical processes, and the transformation of our mode of awareness of existence. That is what the scriptures fundamentally tell us in all these ancient symbolic forms. Remember that the Zarathustrian writings, or shall I say the teachings, originated before the days of speculative philosophy and of speculative scientific thought. When scientific thought for the first time presents concepts like the atomic theory and so forth, Zarathustra and Moses and the earliest teachers of the Veda had all preceded them, preceded those scientific speculations. And therefore, the form they chose in which to express their inward spiritual insights was the personalistic form. You will notice that after scientific speculation came on the scene, then the whole God concept begins to assume a different character, because there are philosophic correspondences to scientific speculation. You can work that out for yourself if you consider, for example, the atomic theories that Democritus and Leucippus in Greece and Kapila and Kanada and others in India propounded, also in China. They were more or less within the same two-century period. They flourished then. And after they propounded their theory of atoms, indivisible, invisible, cannot be indestructible. You will find that the philosophic correspondences of that are now ascribed to the Godhead. So the Godhead is no longer presented purely as a being, but as a being with these characteristics, or as a power with these characteristics: invisibility, indivisibility, indestructibility, and so forth. But if one has insight, and if one has really gone into it deeply enough, one will find that the scriptures are talking all the time about you, about me. These people, having emerged out of the conflict and the misery of confinement to the dualistic sphere and realized transcendence, used the available forms of verbal expression appropriate to their age, that is to say, the time in which they lived, in order to convey their realization to others, for their helping. We today can work these things out, provided we understand this fundamental thing. But now look, the soul of creation cries out against violence. See how ancient violence is, rooted in our actual psychophysical being. And there's a footnote here which is very interesting. This presentation has its correspondence in India. This, of course, was in Iran, Azerbaijan probably, northwestern Iran. And in India, in the Bhagavata Purana, in connection with the advent of Sri Krishna, this is how it is put. The earth, oppressed by schemes of princes proud, leagued in their might with countless demon hosts, bowed down with this great burden, approached her great creator seeking help from him, wearing the shape of a cow, two streams of tears flowing down her face, lamenting loud and piteously. With heavy heart she stood and poured out to her Lord her suffering soul. Interesting, isn't it? Again, violence and the suffering due to the violence exercised upon oneself. whether that violence is exercised from outside upon oneself or from inside ourself upon ourself. You see, violence doesn't come merely from the other person upon me. It comes out of me myself upon me and upon other people. This is something which we must really appreciate and understand. Because if we don't appreciate it, if we remain isolated from others in our own conception of life and ourselves and our relationship to others, if we remain isolated and separate, we can never take the right steps in this matter and become free of the tyranny and the horror of violence. The Buddha talks of suffering. That is how he puts it. But what is suffering? But a violence, is it not? It's a violence upon oneself, or it may be a violence upon others. We tend to look back into the past with nostalgia and talk about, oh, the good old days and the golden age and this, that and the other. But let me just read something from the Anguttara Nikaya, the gradual sayings, as they are called, of the Buddhists. This is a chapter which deals with the punishments meted out to robbers and adulterers and other criminals in those days. This is in the Buddha's own lifetime. And remember, such beings as the Buddha flourished then, and within a century of that golden age of the supreme insights of the great Upanishadic teachers. And one is inclined to have a glamorous picture of India of those days, a wonderful place. There are these great sages and their disciples, you know, floating about in heavenly atmospheres and all the rest of it, all becoming enlightened, you know, and the stars in heaven shining brighter than ever, and flowers falling out of the sky unseasonable times. This is actually stated in Buddhist scriptures, you see. And thereupon flowers fell from the sky and so forth and so forth. All right. Now that we have to be truthful, shall I say. I won't say realistic, but we just have to be truthful. What was the fact of the situation? In the first place, remember that the Buddha left home and everything because he was pierced to the quick with the suffering around him. He must have himself suffered deeply right from his childhood onwards. The charming tales we have, especially the description of the Lalita Vistara, you see, which gives a glamorous presentation, you see, here is this wonderful divine, almost divine child who knows everything and is perfectly healthy, perfectly happy. Everything goes like a fairy tale, without the fairy, of course, and so forth. All that rather deluding description blinds us to what was the actual fact present in his day and in his time, and the extraordinary cruelty and violence around him. Why did he, otherwise would he have emphasized compassion above all? Wisdom, yes. But wisdom is a cool thing. It is not a reaction against anything. It is a disentanglement from the state of ignorance but compassion. And note how the Buddha talks of compassion. It's extraordinary. So now, in his time, this is how violence was exercised by man upon man. Monks, one sees rulers seize a robber, a miscreant, and subjecting him to diverse forms of punishment, flogging him, cutting off his hand, his foot, his hand and foot, his ear, nose, ear, or ear and nose, torturing him with the gruel pot. Now this gruel pot was this. They took off the top of his skull and dropped a red-hot iron ball so that the brains boiled over. With the chank shave. The chank shave consisted of rubbing the skull of the miscreant with gravel until it was as smooth as a shell. Yes? That's why I said at the beginning, let us listen with a very calm mind. Let us listen with a very calm mind, but with a totally sensitive heart. Otherwise nothing happens. We hear this, we go through an emotion, and when we go outside, we are little different. Listen to it very sensitively. With a heart that is totally vulnerable, meaning impressible, wholly impressible. This is essential. Otherwise, no wisdom can emerge. Unless the heart is warm and impressible, and therefore willing to respond totally and completely to anything and everything. And let the intellect be calm and cool, perfectly poised, immovable, so that one will see the fact in its wholeness, in its entire truth. The intellect is cool, cold. The heart is warm. And both are needed simultaneously in order that compassion and wisdom may emerge. Otherwise, there is no possible solution. We'll confine ourselves to our consideration for this afternoon to the whole problem of violence. There is no solution to it otherwise. With the fire garland, the body was smeared with oil and set alight. And it goes on like that. The Buddha quietly tells this to the disciples. This is the kind of thing that happened in his day and age. We have a little illusion that the people of India are so meek and mild and gentle. A great many of them may be now. Hundreds of millions are only hardly half fed. It's not easy to be the opposite of meek and mild if hunger has worked its ravages. But in these days, they weren't so hungry. The population was small. And they were a fierce, vigorous people. So that they exercised this sort of cruelty. Now, let us go on to the teaching of the Buddha in its essential aspect, which is the healing ointment for this state of affairs. And he addresses himself to each and every individual. He never suggests any political measures, any legal measures, any educational measures, any social measures, or economic measures. Never suggests any of those. And this is a fact which we must really look into and fully understand the significance and implications of. All these measures, political, economic, social, educational, legal, etc., are imprisoned in duality, which means the realm of conflict. Healing, whole making of the conflict within duality cannot emerge out of duality. It has to come from a transcendent source which has finished with the conflict and the darkness of duality. This is the important point. And do remember that every one of the great teachers, without exception, gave the transcendent answer, the heavenly answer, to every dualistic and earthly problem. This is a point of tremendous significance. It's always the transcendent answer, the religious answer, the answer which comes out of the religious being who has fulfilled himself as a human being. The transcendent answer is the one and only answer to all problems. One may perhaps use a very rough and ready analogy. We all remember having to deal with quadratic equations at school. All quadratics are solved by the great solver, the great solvent. X equals minus b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac upon 2a. See? Have I said it correctly? Or yes, all right. Still remember it after 60 years. See, there is your solvent. It is the transcendent solution. And you just apply that to every single separate quadratic equation, which is the problem. And the problem is solved thereby. All right? In the same way, the great spiritual teachers always gave the transcendent answer for solving any and every earthly problem in the realm of duality. Out of duality, there is no solution. I keep on repeating this because I have seen the truth of this. This is absolutely true. And if we can wake up from within ourselves to this, then we can contribute all that is possible for us to contribute towards the healing of this problem of violence. Now look at the extent to which one must go. You know the three great things which the Buddha presents is the silas, that is the moralities, samadhi, that is the meditation part of the story, and panya, unerring insight. Don't use terms like intuition and so forth, although they have been very popular in English translation. Unerring insight is panya. You just don't go wrong. You know. And this is also the real meaning of the Sanskrit word which is used in Hinduism, buddhi. Buddhi is not just intellect. It is not intuition. A blackguard can have first-class intuitions to carry out his villainy. But it's unerring insight. And that comes out of only the perfected Holy One. So the transcendent answer. So now look, here is a particularly interesting discourse. It's a conversation between Bakula, who is a very old man, and a younger bhikkhu, Kassapa. And Kassapa comes along and asks Bakula, how long is it since you have gone forth from the home life into the homeless state? And Bakula says, 80 years. And Kassapa asks, during those 80 years, have you ever committed sexual intercourse? And Bakula says, you should not formulate your question that way. You should formulate your question this way. Did perceptions of sensual pleasure rise in you during those 80 years? Just to cotton on to one particular aspect of it is a partial thing. But the whole realm of sense pleasure is the total thing. Therefore, it's more sensible to ask the question, to formulate the question that way, rather than ask a specific thing. So, Kassapa says, all right, during the 80 years, did any perceptions of sensual pleasure ever arise in you? During the 80 years that I have gone forth, friend Kassapa, I am not aware of any perception of sensual pleasure rising in me. Be very sensitive to this. Don't just believe it. That's not the sensitivity. Really feel it out. The extraordinary significance of this. Can I live like that for 80 years? Can any of us? This transcendent purity. And he goes on to say, during the 80 years that I have gone forth, I am not aware of any perception of malevolence. Any perception of harming rising in me. And so on, he goes through the points. Which means that violence is never met with violence. Harming is never met with harming. And this applies not merely to one's bodily life and existence, but as the Shandilya Upanishad, for instance, puts it with unending detail every time it mentions a particular virtue, in thought and feeling, in speech and in act, let there be complete harmlessness. In thought and feeling, speech and act, complete truthfulness, continence, kindliness, etc., etc., etc. You see the meaning of trying to live the holy life, the religious life. Now notice very carefully. One is not only not violent to anybody else in thought and feeling and speech and act, but not one is not violent with oneself. When I get annoyed with myself, when I feel like kicking myself for having made a mistake or failed in this, that or the other, I'm violent with myself. And as long as I'm capable of violence with myself, I will always be capable, in that moment of forgetfulness when the provocation was sufficiently great, to be violent to the other person. It'll slip out. So you see the implication. If there is this complete harmlessness with respect in relation to others as well as in relation to oneself, then the whole problem of violence in one's own being is completely out. One's whole psychical nature as well as one's physical activity is non-violent. There is no reaction of hate or of violence. And what does that imply? That one's existence in the world is sending out, is a center, shall I say, of non-violence. It is the miracle of just a little stone, if you like, stemming the course of a devastating flood. The physical analogy is not too good, for the simple reason that water is a substance which moves its way and the stone is a thing which stays put. But psychically, this little stone represents yourself, the purified one, freed of all violence. And it doesn't stem the rushing waters of violence from outside. It transforms those rushing waters so that they are destructive. Their destructiveness is completely gone. This is what happens in the psyche. The power of attention, your power of attention is your instrument of salvation, remember. That is why the mind is so tremendously important. It's your instrument of salvation. And how does it work? It works as if in a laboratory where the dross is not burnt away but converted into the pure gold, so that you get gold plus gold as a result of that burning. And this is the transformation of the psychical energies. So there is the answer to the question of violence. The transcendent answer every time. no physical measures, no compensatory efforts will ever solve the problem. I'm quoting today more than I've ever done in any of these meetings in these 10 years, but it is worth it. Like to draw that curtain a little bit. Oh, doesn't do it, sorry. Now look, here is a discourse of the Buddha to one called Punna. No, that's all right, I can see. Thank you. Punna approaches the Buddha and says, can you give me, in brief, an exhortation which I can use for complete liberation? And the Buddha says, there are, Punna, material shapes cognizable by the eye, agreeable, pleasant, liked, enticing, connected with sensual pleasures, alluring. If a monk delights in these, then because he delights in them, welcomes them and persists in cleaving to them, that delight is followed by the uprising of anguish. Sense pleasures all lie within the dualistic sphere. With the ending of a sense pleasure, there is always misery, sorrow, anguish. And the desire, the urge to grasp at it again. So that there is everlastingly this oscillation between pleasure and pain. That is, if you welcome the thing, if you cleave unto it, if you invite it, if you pursue it, what comes naturally, you see a beautiful sunset. And you are uplifted. You hear marvelous music, see a handsome face, a beautiful woman, or whatever it is. And there is the delight which has not been grasped at and to which one doesn't cling. Then that's pure delight. It is not in the dualistic sphere. That's the whole point. It is the grasping, the inviting, the pursuing, which involves the separation of that and me. You see? Don't think that the religious teachers were killjoys. Far from it. They really knew how to be happy. We don't. You see? So he talks about sense pleasures like this in justice. Few paragraphs, and then Punna says that he wants to go to Sunaparanta and practice the teaching. But the Buddha knows Sunaparanta, and he says, Punna, the people of Sunaparanta are fierce, they are rough. If the people there revile and abuse you, Punna, how will it be for you then? So, Punna says, if the people of Sunaparanta revile and abuse me, I will say, goodly indeed are these people, indeed very goodly are these people of Sunaparanta, in that they do not strike me a blow with their hands. But supposing they do strike you a blow with their hands, says the Buddha. And Punna replies, I will say, goodly indeed, very goodly indeed are these people, in that they do not strike me a blow with clods of earth. And the Buddha goes on, but supposing they do strike you with clods of earth, and he goes on and on, makes it fiercer and fiercer each time, until finally he says that if they deprive you of life with a sharp knife, how will it be for you then? And Punna says, so many people amongst the bhikkhus, well, not so many, but quite a few of them, have had to take a knife unto themselves because their disease or illness was totally unbearable and end it that way. See? End their pain that way. But here, I will say how good it is that I didn't have to take a knife to myself, but it was there and it did its job. Now, of course, discourses like that are somewhat amusing, if you like. And we would say, well, really, you take it with a pinch of salt, or you think that the person has said it with his tongue in his cheek. But please, consider it carefully. Consider the significance of all this. It has to be transcendent all along the line. Take that other discourse, the parable of the saw, as it is called, the Kakuchupama Sutta. And it ends up by the Buddha saying, monks, even if low-down thieves were to carve you limb from limb with a double-handled saw, even then you should entertain no enmity against those thieves. If you do entertain enmity in your mind, then you are not doers of my teaching. Now look, life throws up things against us, doesn't it? All along the line. Difficulties, problems, the treachery of others, the inconsiderateness, the deep pains inflicted upon us, and so forth. And also, the pains we inflict upon ourselves. All human beings are, in the dualistic state, a mixture of sadist and masochist. We are a mixture of the two. How shall we respond to this situation? Actually, we merely react to it. Anger or contempt for the person who is the wrongdoer and hurts us and so forth, or contempt for ourselves if we have done something wrong. But this way lies no solution. There has to be complete understanding and this kind of transcendent love which will never react with anger, violence, hate, malevolence, ill will, and all the rest of it. Never react. And you will, naturally one asks, well, how does one do it? You are the doer. Ask yourself, how do I do it? Be fully awake all the time to what is going on in the mind. be fully attentive to what is actually present here and now. Just watch it. But watch it sensitively. That is to say, don't watch the painful, horrible thing that is coming to you, that has come to you, with the feeling at the back of your mind, ah, now, the great man has said, watch it, and I am watching it, and I shall escape the pain. Not a bit of it. Don't do that. That's the very way which you should avoid. Feel it fully. Be fully awake to what you feel. And let the intellect look quite coolly at it. When the two are there together, when this intense sensitivity is there, plus the looking by the intellect, by the cool intellect, the transformation of that destructive psychical energy takes place into a constructive psychical energy. Now, this calm, clear looking, I, as I am, cannot look calmly and clearly. My calm will be a forcible calm. Now then, just sit quiet and keep looking. Don't give way to it. I'm fighting with myself all the time. And I'm deluding myself that I'm looking clearly, because I forget that this intellect which is looking is a conditioned intellect. It is conditioned right from my infancy onwards. All the things that I have been taught, do this, don't do that, all the do's and the don'ts, I've never investigated them, I've never looked into them, I just take them for granted. At least those which I have taken for granted and which I have allowed to influence my life. Certain ideas have been put before me by my parents, by my teachers at school, by my friends, by the club rules, by the traditions of the country. It is not done to behave like this or like that, and so forth. All those things. All my beliefs, my biases, my prejudices, my preconceptions, and my assumptions. All these things condition the mind. And so this intellect which is looking on through colored glasses with blinkers by the side. So you see, this is no child's play. It is a serious thing. It is a very serious thing. But try. If you care. If you don't care, don't try. But if you don't care and you don't try, violence will go on, evil will go on, suffering will go on triumphantly. But don't rise up and say, in the spirit of the champion of God and truth and happiness and beauty and all the rest of it, I'll fight against these things, conquer them. You conquer nothing whatsoever. Your invincibility lies in your infinite resilience. If you resist, you are in duality, in conflict. If you are infinitely resilient in your mind, you will totally and completely absorb everything. And in that absorbing, the transformation of all the conflicting forces takes place. It's like having the digestion of a horse, as they say. He can digest anything. The psyche can do it. The psyche can And it does have the faculty of having the digestion of a horse. But in order to digest, you must take it in, mustn't you? First, you must ingest before you can digest. That is why, do not refuse life. Do not prevent life. Do not prevent pain, violence, suffering, sorrow, or what is happiness, fruition, fulfillment, the wonderful, and all the rest of it. Prevent nothing. Live in it. Live through it. But live as a human being. And as a human, the one in whom all evil-mindedness has been burnt out. The power of transformation is there. And if that power of transformation works in our own being, and all violence is out, so that whatsoever happens, you will never find a reaction of hate or anger or destructiveness rising up in you. If you find yourself in that state, then you are a benediction upon your whole environment, upon the whole human race.